Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of March 5th, 2015. This week, we're pleased to be joined by our frequent guest, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Yes, how are you doing?
Great, great to have you here. So before we begin, here's a technical note. Longtime listeners to the show will notice that over the last month or so, we have been posting 15-minute shows instead of our typical 30-minute shows. We're trying, of course, in the spirit of continuous improvement, to always provide a product that people like to listen to. But it's unclear to us which length of show is the best. So I'd ask you, if you have an opinion, and I'm sure you do, please go to the Facebook page associated with this show and just let us know whether you like 30 or 15. Your comment can be short. In fact, it could be 30 or 15, and we will do the counting. Of course, if there are any topics you'd like to hear about, let us know. But we certainly would like to make sure that the shows that we produce match up to your listening habits. So please help us out. Give us a ring, so to speak. So, DR, this was an interesting week. And In today's show, I think we're going to take a little bit of a philosophical bent to stuff that is timely and in the news. So just so that everyone knows, this past week, the blogger Dave Roberts at Grist put up a post that made reference to someone called, nicknamed Dr. Evil, right? What's his name? Berman?
Richard Berman, which rhymes Berman. With Furman.
And he, this gentleman, will explain what he does, but he is a big cog in the machine of the climate denial machine. And we're going to talk about it a little for the following reason, because it's important that we as climate hawks know who our enemies are and how our enemies operate. I mean, that's, who's the guy, Lao Tzu said, know your enemy, or Aristotle or someone said, know your enemy, because that helps you fight them. Mm-hmm. It's important because these guys that we'll talk about are using very sophisticated psychological techniques to influence public opinion in a way that we need to be ready to counteract. So that's why we're on this topic. And so, DR, let me give you the floor for a couple of minutes and tell me who this character is and why Dave Roberts wrote about him.
Well, Richard Berman is, for movie fans, he was one of the models for the Aaron Eckhart character in the film Thank You for Smoking, which came out about 10 years ago. For the past 30 years or so, he's been involved in lobbying on behalf of various controversial entities, lobbying on behalf of the alcohol industry, the healthcare industry, the tobacco industry, and now, according to a 2014 report in the New York Times, he's moved on to lobbying on behalf of the fossil fuel industry and launching these highly personalized and vicious and savage attacks on climate change activists. And David Roberts wrote earlier this week about Mr. Berman's tactics, and also Think Progress has also written about his tactics and how they are specifically going after, how Berman's organizations are specifically going after supporters of the EPA Clean Power Plan. And this is a time-honored tactic he's used for decades of trying to spin supporters of public health as some sort of radical or anti-American or anti-business sort of, some sort of evil cabal, basically. And in doing so, he's generated a lot of controversy with 60 Minutes in 2007 branded him Dr. Evil, and he basically boasted about that claim. He basically openly admits that he's essentially a shill for polluting interests.
Well, those people who follow this show in the Facebook page will note that on February 14th was the divestment day, and one of the targets of the campaign of this Mr. Berman, Dr. Evil, was the divestment campaign, and he put up this ridiculous-looking video, not video, animation about please fall in love with fossil fuel and how basically all the mean kids talked to Johnny and tried to talk him out of loving fossil fuels. And it showed, this video showed a hilarious picture of Bill McKibben as a evil character. And even when I saw it, I said, this video is ridiculous, right? But I think that Berman is playing to people that are less psychologically aware than you or I or our listeners, and that this kind of stuff targets people in ways that they can glom onto. I mean, what Dave Roberts said in his report about Mr. Berman, he listed up 7 different principles of operation that Berman has. One is that to always be on the offense, that once you're defensive, you're losing, you want to be making attacks all the time because that puts you in a stronger position, that the best way, the best strategy is ad hominem attacks. And for those who don't know, never studied Latin, ad hominem means towards the man, to destroy the messenger. He believes in being first and establishing common knowledge, that is to say, to define, I don't know, the death tax as the word, right? And then everyone has to use that vocabulary. He's the first one there. According to Roberts, Mr. Berman maintains that a tie is a win if you're trying to defend the status quo, that humor is a good thing to use, that emotions trump facts because people, especially negative emotions, people remember. And another one about putting kids in viral videos. But there's this list of techniques that Dave Roberts, the grist blogger, points out that Mr. Berman, Dr. Evil, uses. But then Roberts goes on to raise the following question, and I will see if I can pull it up on my iPad here. So Roberts' point is the following, is that there is this, let's call him a vicious Dr. Evil, doing nasty things about the climate. And there's no one on the quote-unquote climate hawk side that is equally vicious, that is doing the same things. And Roberts, I'll quote him, says, "My impression when I hear liberals discussing public opinion and communications is that they often conflate what will work with what is good or righteous or honest." Their goal is to change public opinion, yes, but those liberals, they are also keenly interested in being viewed in a certain way, in being perceived as honest or objective or nonpartisan. Again, they, those liberals, confuse strategies that appeal to them personally, their own values and their own worldviews. They confuse that with strategies that produce the desired outcomes. And so basically, Dave Roberts is saying, hey, liberals, how come you're not as vicious as Dr. Evil? And for me, that comes up as a question that says, does the end justify the means, right? Can you be as nasty as you want in saving the planet because the stakes are so high? Right? Did I sort of get that right, DR? You read the article, too. What did you pick out of it?
It reminds me of two controversies from 1964. And the first controversy is the famous line from the presidential candidate Barry Goldwater, who famously said that extremism in the defense of liberty is not a vice and moderation in the pursuit of justice is not a virtue. And then a couple of months later, there was another controversy involving the so-called Daisy ad, which Lyndon Johnson ran against Barry Goldwater. Lyndon Johnson seizing upon remarks Barry Goldwater had made, implying that he would not hesitate to use nuclear tactics in order to win the Vietnam War. And in the ad, we famously see a young girl picking at a daisy and counting down the daisies. And then you hear a loud countdown of a nuclear bomb about to go off. And then remarks from Lyndon Johnson basically very subtly implying that if Goldwater won the presidency, he'd start a nuclear war. Now, that ad has been roundly criticized for years as being an example of negative campaigning, but a lot of defenders of the ad pointed out that the tactic, while quote-unquote harsh, worked in terms of securing a victory for what people would argue was the progressive side in the argument. So I'm reminded of that controversy, and I think what David Roberts is implying is that if something like the Daisy ad happened today, and if tactics were used today, there'd be a lot of tutting from people who would say, oh, those tactics are being too harsh or being too over the edge. But if the tactic is successful, then what is necessarily wrong with the tactic? I mean, when you think about the issue, and you think about this particular issue, and that if one side scores a victory, then, as former Congressman Rush Holt once said, millions will die, then naturally you have to ask the question, what do you have to do to stop millions of people from dying?
True enough. But I guess my reaction to the whole question of whether or not the ends justify the means is to refer to, I guess, a hero of mine, but Mohandas Gandhi, who always made the point as he was opposing the British Empire, was that the ends and the means are the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. That Gandhi was trying to build a society that was based on truth and justice, and so you had to use truth and justice in building that society. You couldn't use nefarious means and then at the end, you know, pull a plug and say, oh, now we're all going to be just. So mm-hmm. I would argue that people, shall we, you know, Dave Roberts liberals are not interested in being perceived as nice guys, but they say they see that a good process, an honest and open process, will result in an honest and good result that has that will outlast us all.
Mm-hmm.
So I take issue with Roberts, you know, the tone of his question. And having said that, I think that the ends and the means are the same thing. So you have to be honest and trustworthy in your process. Mm-hmm. I think that the things that Roberts has described, right, always being on the offensive, you know, humor works, emotions trump emotions trump facts. But I mean, those are all reasonable techniques for climate hawks to use, assuming we have the truth on our side.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you have an ad hominem attack against, let's say, David Koch, mm-hmm. right, and you try and portray him as a bad actor, as long as you have the facts and those facts are correct, it seems to me that's okay. That's fair game.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
But when you mentioned that, you know, it's okay so long as you have the facts, I'm reminded of a line Al Franken used to use back when he was a radio host, where he said, you know, the only thing we have on our side is the truth. And it goes back to, you know, again, obviously, I think this discussion is really depending on what constitutes a lowbrow or a gutter tactic. Using, you know, truth is not a pot shot. It's not a low blow. I think about this in the context of the whole controversy about David Corn of Mother Jones and some of his criticism of Bill O'Reilly, none of which has been really refuted by Bill O'Reilly or Bill O'Reilly's supporters, even though Bill O'Reilly and his supporters have used ad hominem attacks on David Corn. And it's just noticeable that what David Corn has done, he simply used truth as the core of his criticism and the core of his expose. So I mean, there is that argument you make about Gandhi. You know, Gandhi, you know, saying, you know, we must be the change we want to be. But the fact of the matter is, again, it goes back to, at the end of the day, it's a street fight, and either you win the street fight or you lose the street fight. And you can use, and so long as you're using truth, you can use aggressive tactics with truth as your weapon in order to win that street fight.
Well, I guess, I mean, then you take it one step further, and you have to ask, I mean, in modern society, in postmodern society, truth is a slippery thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
People think they have their own personal truth. And I'm mm-hmm. sure that David Koch and even Dr. Evil here, Mr. Berman, I'm sure they believe in the righteousness of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so they think they have the truth. And you mm-hmm. think You have the early, I think I have the truth. So the question comes, what constitutes truth? And of course, that's subject of many philosophical treaties all around. But for my money, and what I remember is that there are two things that make something true. One is that you have to believe it to be true, and the other is that it has to actually be true. It has to comport with the facts. So that if you honestly believe something that is not factually true, it's that doesn't make it true. And of course, that goes right into all the climate deniers and why climate hawks have the upper hand, because climate hawks have facts that are established outside of one person's psyche or one person's ideology, right? We can all agree the temperatures are rising. There's this generalized theory of facts that says these things are true, which is what allows you to believe in it and feel that in fact it is true because, there's facts behind it. And so, I mean, this definition of truth is a little bit circular, right? But I think David Koch and Mr. Berman and even Mr. O'Reilly, much as he might believe he was in the Falklands, right? They weren't, so it's not true. And so I think that climate hawks are on the right side of the battle here. You've got the truth. You should be as aggressive as you possibly can. And if we want to use Mr. Berman's techniques, other than emotions trump facts. I mean, emotions trump a lot of stuff, but you can use emotions in service of the facts, right? And still, you look at yourself in the mirror in the morning.
Well, I think this is a discussion about the difference between truth and what Stephen Colbert famously called truthiness. And I think that when you're dealing with people like Koch and Berman and O'Reilly, they're embracing truthiness, but not truth. It goes back to that whole. I think it was the Karl Rove line when we dismissively referred to as the reality-based community versus people who invent their own reality. And I think that when you're talking about people like Koch or Berman and O'Reilly, you're dealing with people who have invented their own reality and have a lot of money to basically create their own fantasy world, while in the real world, people are suffering as a result of what they do in that fantasy world. And it's up to people who live in the reality-based community to use truth as their weapon to sort of break down the citadel of that false reality being promoted by people like Mr. Berman.
So I got one more curveball for you, DR. What color was the dress? Was it blue with white? Let me see. Blue with black trim or white with gold trim?
Honestly, I didn't care what color the dress was. I just thought the whole thing was just completely silly. I mean.
But the various debates about that talked about the science of perception. That some people who saw it different ways were not lying, right? They were saying what their eyes saw told them. And that leads us down into a whole other avenue of, and I think Steve Mooney of Climate Desk has done exploring all this stuff, sort of the conservative brain versus the liberal brain. I mean, how do you apprehend facts and how do you sort them? Which is a much deeper question than we have time to go into here. But I think the dress thing is tells us a lot about how people perceive the world, right?
Yeah, it's as I said before, I didn't really get into that controversy, but there is that question of how do people perceive things? Do people perceive things? It's like the whole the whole discussion of what constitutes unconscious bias. Can something can there really be such a thing as unconscious bias? Is a bias not on some level conscious? This ties into the whole thing about people's perceptions of climate science being skewed by their perceptions of Al Gore, where if they hate Al Gore, they reject the science, but if
Well,
they're
it's an
not
ad hominem
dismissive of
attack,
Al
right? They,
Gore,
you, you, you,
exactly.
you've, but I mean, just we can't go too far down this path. But there was one article that I read that took sort of the liberal conservative divide all the way back thousands of years to hunter gatherer tribes, right? And at that time, if you're a hunter gatherer, you're living by the riverbank, and you hear, over the next hill that there's a new tribe, or you see smoke from a tribe over the hill, for your little band, there's a distinction. Some people say we have to hide from them, or we got to go kill them, right? And that's your conservative side, and they're not completely wrong. And then there's another mindset that says, gee, we should go meet those people. Maybe we can learn something from them. And that's kind of a liberal side, right? And those approaches to life, even today, come through. I mean, conservatives are not crazy in saying that, I think it was John Locke, right, saying that, you know, you do things the way you've always done them because the way you've always done them kind of works. Right. As opposed, but on the other hand, when conditions change, you have to be able to adapt to the future, which is the other side of the bench, so to speak. So it's, I think it's an interesting discussion.
And then there's the whole the line, you know, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do? And what do people do when they're presented with facts and they won't change their minds, or they're paid not to change their minds, or they have an ideological direction to not want to change their minds under any circumstances? That's where the conflict comes in.
Right. And that's intellectual dishonesty, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I guess there was one other topic. We've already gone well over our allotted 15 minutes, DR. The other topic we wanted to touch on was the one that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which we have touched on this show a couple of times now, literally is coming down the track very quickly and may be voted on this week. So, again, what's going to be voted on is Congress will be asked to vote on a piece of legislation that would grant to the president the right to negotiate this treaty in secret. And then when he's done negotiating that treaty, he comes back and he presents a full package to the Congress, and they either have to vote it up or down. They cannot amend it. They take the whole thing as it is. It's called fast track legislation. And from a climate perspective, many people are very unhappy about it, in particular because it provides, within the proposed treaty language, it sets up independent legal tribunals where disputes among the different countries will be settled. So it won't be settled, these things won't be settled in American courts. It'll be set in these tribunals that are basically corporate courts, in which companies can sue countries for damage from environmental regulations. And of course, if that doesn't set off alarm bells in your head as a climate hawk, it should, because, you know, a carbon tax is going to make somebody, some oil company, lose money. And if they can then sue the United States for that loss, it really is a dangerous thing. Right, DR?
Exactly. And 2 points should be raised here. Number one, there was a great op-ed about this issue in the March 2nd Los Angeles Times by former Labor Secretary Robert Reich and Richard Trumka of the AFL-CIO, urging people to try to stop this deal in its tracks. And there was also a great speech on February the 26th, I believe February the 26th, by Senator Bernie Sanders on the floor of the United States Senate, condemning the mainstream press for totally ignoring the ramifications of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And number two, you can make an argument that this should be, for climate hawks, about as big as the effort to stop the Keystone XL pipeline, because if you think about it, if the Trans-Pacific Partnership goes through, not just a potential carbon tax, but any sort of environmental regulation, whether it be, you know, the Clean Power Plan, or theoretically even the Clean Air Act itself, could be subject to being scaled back or quashed if it runs afoul of the tenets of the TPP. So people really need to think seriously about just how big and bad this deal is.
What we'll do is we'll put up a link to all of the contact information for congressmen, no matter what state you live in, and of course here in Massachusetts we'll have a list as well, but this is a good time to contact your congressman and tell him how you feel about the TPP. So the other thing, DR, that we need to mention, or we want to mention, is that on March 15th of this year, just a couple of weeks from now, at Northeastern University, right in the heart of Boston, the MCAN Toxic Action Center annual conference called Local Environmental Action will happen. It'll be Sunday morning from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's going to be a great Great conference with all kinds of information for all kinds of skill levels. Even if you've never been to a climate conference, here's your chance to get your feet wet. You'll be welcomed with open arms. You can meet other people who think like you. It's a great deal. We'll put up a link to it, but it's localenvironmentalaction2015.org. So, DR and our listeners, you can catch up to the links on most of what we talked about at our blog. It's a WordPress blog, massclimateaction.wordpress. You can go to Facebook, Facebook/massclimateaction. And if you want there, even though we're now at almost 25 minutes of time, you can tell us if you like 15 minutes or 30-minute show length so that we can try and tune it to make you a happy listener. You can listen to the show directly on your iPhone using Stitcher, or you can find us on iTunes where you can subscribe, review us, bump us up in the standings. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon pollution. Thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone else for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.
Very cool.